This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
And the Dagoba Group, a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice with specialties in unconscious bias, leadership dynamics, and client engagement. Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend. More at thedagobagroup.com.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. This week, public radio listeners are being asked this question: how do you feel about trade? During this presidential season, there's been a lot more attention to this issue. Broadly, candidates and voters are talking about the economic and personal impact of open international commerce and whether, on balance, it benefits Americans or not. And specifically, you hear lots of people talking about the detailed pros and cons of particular trade deals, from the 22-year-old NAFTA agreement to the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP, under debate right now. This week, as part of NPR's A Nation Engaged project, the network's reporters and member stations around the country are re-examining this topic, including here at NHPR. And so this hour in The Exchange, we're talking trade from a New Hampshire and national perspective. And let's hear from you. How would you answer that basic question? How do you feel about trade? The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We begin the hour with Danielle Kurtzleben. She's a political reporter for NPR. She's been looking at this topic. She joins us from D.C. And Danielle, welcome.
Yes, thank you.
How much is trade a factor in this year's presidential campaigns, Danielle?
Well, you know, it depends on the candidate and it depends on the state that they're in. So you have a candidate like Bernie Sanders or Donald Trump, these candidates that tend to get put into this sort of what we call, you know, the populist category. Those two talk about trade a lot. You hear Bernie Sanders talk a lot about the TPP, that is the Trans-Pacific Partnership, that really huge trade deal that's being negotiated with a bunch of Asia-Pacific countries. He brings that up a lot, and he will rail against it and say that, you know, it was created by special interests, is his line. Donald Trump, meanwhile, wants to ratchet up tariffs on countries like China and Mexico. His message is one of the more strongly anti-trade messages of this election. But you're hearing a lot of other messages around the trail. You know, Ted Cruz will say, for example, that he is in favor of free trade, but just not this deal. Hillary Clinton has supported some trade deals in the past, but this particular one, TPP, not so much her. John Kasich is the only major candidate in favor of the current Trans-Pacific Partnership. So you're hearing a lot of sort of an array of messages, but it also depends on the state. You heard a lot more about this in Ohio and Michigan, states that are very manufacturing heavy, and where, you know, candidates talked a lot about closing factories. Then you hear about trade in, you know, say a state like Iowa.
Yeah, so the messages you're hearing from these candidates partly depends on who they are and where they are. And it sounds like they're talking, Danielle, broadly about trade and then more specifically about this TPP, Trans-Pacific Partnership. Given Hillary Clinton's long involvement in politics and that her husband was instrumental in NAFTA, how much are you hearing about NAFTA, even though it's 22 years old?
You're hearing some about it. Once again, it depends on the state. And I imagine that we'll hear a bit more about it in Pennsylvania, because Pennsylvania, of course, is, you know, kind of in that region of Rust Belt states that has some manufacturing in it as well. And I imagine you're hearing a little bit about it in New York right now as well, up in, you know, the upstate region. So NAFTA gets lumped in because it, for one thing, it gets lumped in especially on the Democrat side, because Bernie Sanders, of course, has an anti-NAFTA message, and he will criticize Hillary Clinton on that. So it is really interesting to see a trade deal that's, you know, 20 years old keep popping up in the national conversation now. But it certainly is, because it's one of the last big examples of a trade deal that they can bring up and talk about its positives and negatives.
Well, let's talk about the voters, Danielle. What does the polling indicate in terms of how, broadly first, please, most Americans feel about trade, about relatively open international commerce?
Sure. So this is what I think is one of the most interesting things here. So you have all of these candidates saying, you know, that sort of indicating that trade is kind of scarier, that, you know, it costs jobs. But according to Gallup, 58% of Americans see trade as an opportunity. Only 34% see it as a threat. So Americans really, broadly speaking, are kind of okay with trade. But this is one of those things where public opinion research, you know, there's a lot hidden under those numbers because, you know, this is just bound to be messy. Think about it this way. When politicians talk about the problems of trade, what are they saying? They're usually saying that trade creates job losses. Well, those job losses affect a very small sliver of Americans. And, of course, for those Americans, they naturally have strong feelings about trade. They quite naturally feel upset about trade, and, you know, you can't really blame them. For the rest of us, a lot of mainstream economists would say that we get big gains from trade, but we just don't see them very easily. When someone goes to H&M and gets a cheap dress, they're not really voting on that. They're just getting it, and they may not even attribute it to trade. So the gains of trade are not terribly visible to people, but the losses are visible to a smaller fraction of people. And that's very hard to pick up in public opinion.
So paying a little bit less because, you know, imports help lower prices in some instances, you know, we might notice that, we might not. But when someone loses a job, boy, they notice it.
Oh, absolutely. And of course, that's going to affect your vote. That of course, shows up in some of these states. Once again, this is was a major line of attack that Bernie Sanders had in Michigan and Ohio.
How about sentiments about trade among Republican voters versus Democratic voters? Danielle, what differences are there these days between the base of the two political parties?
Sure. So before we get to the base, just to tell you the broad numbers, Democrats, actually, as recently as 2015, were somewhat more likely than Republicans to say trade is an opportunity. The numbers were 61% of Democrats said trade was an opportunity compared to 51% of Republicans, which is pretty interesting. But if you're talking about the base, let's look at Ohio and Michigan again, because those exit polls are maybe a good way to get at this, because those are places where trade is important. The Republican and Democrat numbers really didn't differ much in the exit polls this time around. In all of those states, a little bit more than a majority, you know, 50 to 60% of Democrats and Republicans in the primaries in those two states said they thought trade takes away jobs. Only around one-third of voters in those states from either party said trade creates jobs. So that is, you know, if you're talking about the base, if you're calling that the base, that may be one reason why the candidates, why some of these candidates' anti-trade messages are resonating so well.
So among Democrats, broadly, though, Danielle, they are more likely to favor free trade than Republicans?
As of 2015, yes. And this is a thing that goes back and forth. You know, the Republicans and Democrats are never terribly far apart on this. But up until 2011, Republicans were more likely than Democrats. So if this is a little surprising, yeah, you're right. I mean, there is a certain conventional wisdom that says that, you know, Republicans are more the party of free trade. But among voters, that's not necessarily true.
All right. Danielle, thank you very much. Real interesting.
Of course. Thank you.
Danielle Kurtzleben, again, political reporter for NPR, covering the politics of trade this presidential season. You can join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org, 1-800-892-6477. We're looking at the issue of trade in the presidential race, but also how free trade has affected New Hampshire. Again, you can join us with an email, exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Our guests for the hour are Matt Slaughter, Dean of the Tuck Business School at Dartmouth College. He joins us from Hanover. Matt, thank you for being with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Laura. Pleasure.
Also with us, Jeff Feingold, editor of the New Hampshire Business Review. He's in studio. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, Laura.
And also with us, Glenn Brackett, president of the New Hampshire AFL-CIO. Glenn, welcome. Nice to meet you.
Good morning.
Well, Jeff, I want to start with you. When people look at free trade broadly or these specific agreements that Danielle mentioned, the TPP, NAFTA, they often view it in simple yet stark terms. Who wins? Who loses? recognizing, Jeff, that it's a lot more complicated than that. Still, who has benefited from trade in New Hampshire and who has not?
As you said, Laura, it is a very complicated issue because there's winners and losers as it is anything like economic. For instance, since the introduction of NAFTA, basically, back in the 90s, the value of exports traded and exported by New Hampshire manufacturers has like quadrupled in that time. It's like well over $4 billion a year now, which is a lot of money and a lot of jobs. But at the same time, in that same period, we've talked about it on this show. I know I've been on before talking about it. There's been a decline in the number of manufacturing jobs and the number of manufacturers in New Hampshire. So manufacturers are benefiting, certain manufacturers, especially of electronics, high-tech equipment, things like that. Those are some of the major exports in New Hampshire. But at the same time, some of the old line manufacturers have not benefited. They've either closed up or they've taken advantage of these free trade agreements, specifically NAFTA, and moved their jobs to other countries, especially Mexico and also China is another place where a lot of these jobs have gone because of free trade. So there are employees who have lost their jobs, and there are also manufacturers that are no longer doing business in New Hampshire or doing it on a much smaller level because they've taken advantage of the free trade or they've been hurt by international competition.
In general, Jeff, how would you say New Hampshire business people feel about these free trade agreements, NAFTA, TPP, and so on?
I think for the most part, it's pretty much a free trade crowd kind of thing.
Even though jobs have been lost and gone overseas and so forth?
In terms of I'm not talking about their employees. I'm talking about the business people. I think they're usually very eager to look for new markets. They have understood that because of these free trade agreements, it's not just even that they have an opportunity, it's almost a necessity for them to be engaged internationally because it's all open. The marketplace is huge now. It's not just New England. It's not just the United States. So they have been pretty aggressive, at least the more sophisticated ones. And there's several thousand companies in New Hampshire that do participate in the world, in the international market. And I know the state and the federal government have programs where they try to encourage people and teach them, you know, these are opportunities that you could have. They have these missions to different countries, if the governor's led some over the years. And, I think that they try to become engaged because they understand that's where the opportunities are.
Well, Matt Slaughter, give us your elevator speech, if you could, please. How does free trade benefit the Granite State?
It benefits it through a lot of ways. Jeff referred to one that's very important, which is the ability to find new customers and, as a result, create new business opportunities and ultimately new jobs. It's the case that about 96% of the world's customers live outside of the United States. And when you look at fast growth in so many of these countries, in China and in India in recent years, that's an amazing opportunity for companies in New Hampshire to find new business opportunities and ultimately to create new jobs. So there's a real benefit to businesses. And then, as Danielle said earlier, all of us as consumers, when we go to the store, there's greater variety of things that we can buy at lower prices. So the consumer benefits to trade have long been important. And yet, as we talked about, and we'll talk about some more, not every single worker and company directly to enjoy those benefits. And so it's that tension between the aggregate benefits and the concentration of some of the losses that generate a lot of the political concerns.
And Glenn, I want to ask you about that in just a second. But Matt, so specifically here for New Hampshire, Jeff talked about, you know, some manufacturers winning, some manufacturers losing. Who do you see winning from trade here in New Hampshire?
Yeah, Jeff's definitely right. When you look at the recent data in the past couple of years, the amount of New Hampshire exports going to the world has exceeded $4 billion. And when you look by country, the three biggest destinations for selling goods into the rest of the world are first Canada at over $500 million, Mexico at a little over $500 million, and then third is China. And there's been big growth in China over the past many years. So who's benefiting are the companies, and it's electronics and it's a lot of high-skill, high-technology companies in particular. Those who identify customers, either end users or parts of these global supply chains, those are the companies that are able to really engage in global markets and generate strong benefits to them, to their stakeholders, to their employees.
So when we hear politicians, Matt, talk about, you know, China's killing us, they're flooding us with imports, we're also exporting a lot of stuff to the Chinese.
We are, and that speaks to a deep issue that you raised, Laura, which is, I think, the right way to think about trade's impact on the overall U.S. economy and to New Hampshire specifically is to think about the kinds of jobs, not the number of jobs. So trade, like technological change, is a force that creates real opportunity, or as Jeff said, a lot of businesses see it as a necessity to be engaged in these global markets. And yet at the same time, that spur to innovation and that spur to competition is something that not every company benefits from. And so it's that dynamism of sometimes economists refer to as creative destruction, where we need to think about what are the right policy responses to help those who aren't directly benefiting from all these opportunities.
Well, and Glenn, I'd love to hear from you on this, too. Just your broad thoughts on the benefits and drawbacks that our two guests have talked about.
Well, I don't think anyone's against free trade, fair trade. Our concern is the loss of middle-class jobs. You know, under NAFTA, since NAFTA has been rolled out, 60,000 manufacturing plants have closed in the United States. Over 5 million workers have been laid off. 40% of the displaced manufacturing workers who eventually were reemployed went back to work with a 20 to 25% reduction in wages. Without a manufacturing base in the country, the tax revenue to local communities rolls down to the local taxpayer. The more people you have unemployed, the more social services are needed are required, and you've taken away a manufacturing tax base within the community. It puts a huge strain on the local communities.
Can you link those job losses and the economic inequality that you talk about? And certainly Bernie Sanders has talked a lot about that in his campaign. Can you link that directly to trade, Glenn?
Well, the Bureau of Labor Statistics shows that New Hampshire lost over 26,000 jobs since the NAFTA inception. They also show that workers who certified as lost employment due to import, off-port, offshoring is roughly 12,000. So a lot of people lost their job. And, you know, was it directly attributable to NAFTA? The Bureau of Labor Statistics says that's true.
The Bureau of Labor Statistics is the agency that has to certify that these jobs
yes.
were lost to trade.
Yes.
And from what I understand, it's sometimes not an easy process to make that certification.
No, it's not an easy process, no.
Do you want to jump in, Jeff?
Yeah, I just wanted to say that there's something really that when you look at these trade, the idea of free trade, fair trade, whatever, how it affects New Hampshire, I think a good example is what's happened in terms of the jobs that Glenn's talking about, good old-fashioned middle-class manufacturing jobs. I think something we could all understand pretty easily is how what we've witnessed and seen the disappearance of, actually, the first decline and the disappearance of the paper mills up north. Now, that was thousands of really, really good-paying jobs, union jobs, certainly middle-class jobs, and for many reasons, especially because of trade, of international trade, those mills are no longer viable.
So those jobs were not lost to southern mills in North Carolina,
some
or
were,
Georgia.
But eventually, even those mills are being hurt because there's other countries can do it cheaper. And that's really – I think that's an example of how international trade can affect workers. And the unfortunate thing is that a lot of those people have those old skills working in paper mills. But where do those skills transfer to? That's the thing. They're losing, but there are other people who may be gaining because there's a company like Hypertherm has done really well, or Albany International over on the seacoast that they make these aircraft components, engine components. Those are things that are really high value, but those are not the skills that a paper mill worker could transfer.
So what does he or she
easily.
Do?
Exactly.
Yeah, Matt, I'd love to hear from you on this. You know, economists like that term, creative destruction. But if you're the one being creatively destructed, you're not very happy about it.
Absolutely. And that speaks to the need for policymakers to come up with new and more robustly supported ways, I think, to try to have those individuals whose skills might be devalued by the global economy to have an opportunity to try to find something new to do. That means worker retraining. That's a challenge. Those programs are hard to design. That oftentimes, I think, means relocation assistance. So as Jeff pointed out, for people in the north of the state to think about maybe moving to an area in the south of the state where there's more companies that are growing, Albany International, Hypertherm in our backyard here in Hanover, those types of companies to try to match the workers whose skills are changed because of global trade to have the opportunity to match with the companies that are doing better. That's the essence, I think, what we face in New Hampshire and more broadly in the country to come up with a better trade policy.
Yeah, saying relocate is much, much easier said than done. We'll talk more about that in just a moment and more on this trade debate as it's playing out in the presidential campaign in just a moment. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're talking about the debate over trade in the United States, its impact on New Hampshire, and also how trade is being talked about so much in this presidential campaign trail. 1-800-892-6477 is the number for you to join us. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Glenn Brackett is with us, president of the New Hampshire AFL-CIO, along with Jeff Feingold, editor of New Hampshire Business Review, and joining us from Dartmouth, Matt Slaughter, dean of the Tuck Business School at Dartmouth. And gentlemen, as we talk about trade and how it's being discussed so much in the presidential campaign, two candidates keep coming up, Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders. Let's hear a little bit now from Bernie Sanders. This is Senator Sanders talking about trade policies as the cause of Michigan's economic downfall. This is at the Democratic presidential debate in Flint earlier this year.
You know that in 1960, Detroit, Michigan was one of the wealthiest cities in America. Flint, Michigan was a prosperous city. But then what happened is corporate America said, why do I want to pay somebody in Michigan a living wage when I could pay slave wages in Mexico or China? We're going to shut down. We're going to move abroad. We're going to bring those products back into this country. Those trade policies, as much as any other set of policies, has resulted in the shrinking of the American middle class.
And again, that debate hosted by CNN. That's Bernie Sanders talking about trade at a debate in Michigan. And to you first, I think, Glenn Brackett, he said trade policies, along with other policies, have hurt the American middle class. That's a point that you made earlier. Here's my question for you, Glenn. How much can we just blame trade? Are there other policies that have also contributed to this shrinking middle class that Senator Sanders talks about?
Well, Laura, you know, it's a global economy, and trade is a necessity. But the trade agreements that we have signed so far in this country have guaranteed workers' rights, have guaranteed workers to have the ability to have a certain standard of living. And throughout the world, these standards of living, these agreements have not been lived up to. As far as how what has happened with our local economy, I mean, we've had thousands of people laid off because of trade agreements. I mean, as I said earlier, the Bureau of Labor Statistics tells us that, you know, because of trade agreements, you know, New Hampshire citizens have lost their jobs.
Is it then, Glenn, that free trade, you know, if it were sort of just lowering tariffs, that would be fine? Is it these agreements in particular, the NAFTAs and the TPPs, or is it free trade broadly that's the problem?
Well, I think that removing tariffs has its place. But I believe if you're going to remove tariffs and you acknowledge that it's going to cause a significant loss of employment for New Hampshire and U.S. citizens, then the broad safety net of retraining, of help in the communities needs to take place prior to us removing tariffs. In other words, if we know there's going to be a crash in local communities, we need to be ahead of the curve.
That's interesting. So the problem isn't so much the trade agreements or the lower tariffs. It's that we don't take care of the folks that we know are going to be affected by this up front, before the disruption happens.
Right. And like I said earlier, due to the fact that, you know, when manufacturers leave the community, you lose your tax base. So it becomes double-edged sword. You know, the community cannot afford to help the people that need it the most.
Matt Slaughter, you've written about this, too. I'd love your thoughts.
Glenn raises a really important point, which is trying to be ahead of the curve. And I think we've been behind the curve in U.S. policy conversations to not strengthen the social safety net for workers and communities. So, yeah, it's kind of what you say, Laura. I've written a bit on these types of issues. We could have a whole bunch of new policies at the federal government level and at the state and local level, depending on where to look at things. So I'll mention just a couple. One is trade adjustment assistance. Glenn referred to that earlier. You know, that's a program that was started in the early 1960s. And as well-intentioned as that program is, it's just not designed, and it frankly doesn't have enough funding to speak to the dynamism of the U.S. labor market today. So if you look at the BLS data that Glenn referred to earlier, in recent months in the U.S. economy, over 5 million jobs are destroyed every month in terms of gross worker firm separations. Fortunately, more than that on net are created. So there's about 5.5 million jobs in recent months that got created. So there's so much dynamism in the U.S. labor market every hour that America is open for business that it would be terrific to have a broader, more integrated adjustment program with things like what the president proposed in his current budget of wage loss reinsurance. So there's some things we could do for workers. That's one idea. And then second, Glenn refers to the important impact on communities. Those that have a really concentrated industry mix, when those industries are hit by technological change or international trade or whatever set of forces, that can be a major hit to the tax base, which impacts the schools in particular. So you can imagine a new sort of local tax-based insurance program where different communities could help reinsure each other against those kinds of adverse shocks. And there's ideas that have been kicking around for quite a while in the policy research community. It'd be great to see more attention paid in Washington, D.C. to try to develop and expand these programs.
Well, you said 5 million jobs destroyed, Matt, and luckily 5.5 million created. But the argument often is, yeah, but those new jobs aren't as good as the old ones. You can't support a family on them. They don't come with, you know, sick leave and benefits and so forth.
There's a blend. I mean, that's an important point, Laura. Is every single job that gets created better than some of the ones that were destroyed? No. On net, they are, and that's part of what allows average standards of living in the United States to rise over time. Now, a big issue is for many years running at this point, too many households are not seeing an increase in their average real incomes. That has a lot to do with what economists call productivity and the absence of productivity growth. That speaks to a much broader set of issues than just trade. It speaks to the quality of our primary and secondary schools. It speaks to our dilapidated infrastructure. It speaks to what we do with high-skilled immigration. So you're definitely right to worry about the quality of those jobs, not just the number. And again, that's one of the essential things to keep in mind when we talk about trade.
Go ahead, Jeff.
Yeah, I think what Matt's raising a good point is that I think a lot of this agita, concern about trade, has been bubbling up for many years now since the recession. And I think it does reflect the certain trepidation that Americans in general have about the economy, that there are jobs. There are jobs there. As we know in New Hampshire, we have one of the lowest unemployment rates in the country. But what jobs are those? How many jobs are people – do people have to have two jobs to make up for the one job they used to have?
Are they underemployed?
Absolutely. And I think that kind of concern, as it was also in the 80s and then later on after 9/11, that when the economy is like in a downturn or there's a general feeling that the economy is just not moving along, I think there's much more concern among just regular Americans about trade and about what are the benefits, what are the drawbacks of trade. And I think that's why we're seeing this in this election cycle, that it is becoming an issue that is resonating. And as you can see by at least many of the candidates, they're taking pretty firm stands on trade. And I think that's really reflecting what the anxiety that a lot of Americans are feeling. And I think a lot of people in New Hampshire are feeling.
Well, again, Senator Sanders and Donald Trump are the two candidates often mentioned who are talking most about this. We heard a second ago from Senator Bernie Sanders. Let's hear a little bit about from Donald Trump talking about free trade. And this is a big, big issue for Mr. Trump. Here he is arguing against free trade with China. This is at a rally earlier this week in North Carolina.
All this free trade, you know what? It's free trade for them, not free trade for us. We're losing our shirts. And I think free trade's fine. But the leaders of these other countries, whether it's China, $500 billion a year trade deficit with China. What the hell good is that for us? Where does it help us?
Again, that's Donald Trump talking in North Carolina last month in March. And how would you answer that question, Matt Slaughter? How does all this trade with China help us? China often stands out as a particular target for candidates worried about trade.
Yeah, great question, Laura. I think a lot of the anxiety that Jeff and Glenn and I have talked about these days, it gets personified or in the single country of China. So first of all, just Donald Trump should fact check that trade deficit's more like $330 billion in recent years. It's a little high, but it is a large trade deficit. But that speaks to the way that we get the aggregate gains from trade. So the benefits that accrue to the United States from being able to engage with China and its rise into the global economy, a lot of that we all see as consumers. So if you flip over your iPhone, those of you that might be listening on your phone, you can see that it says designed by Apple in California, assembled in China. And I think that example encapsulates a lot of the engagement that the U.S. has with China. The growth of that market and the fast growth in people's incomes there allows innovative companies like Apple and all kinds of high technology industries in the United States to invest more and create those kinds of jobs. At the same time, what they do a lot more of is the basic assembly and manufacturing of things. So China, I think, summarizes this key dynamic of aggregate benefits for the United States from global engagement, but not every worker and not every company enjoying those benefits.
Let's take some calls, gentlemen. Again, the exchange number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. This week, as part of NPR's A Nation Engage projects, the network and member stations around the country, including this one, are asking listeners, how do you feel about trade? Let's hear from you now. 1-800-892-6477. Join us as we look at trade once again from a New Hampshire and national perspective. Email exchange@nhpr.org or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And gentlemen, up first is Josh in Berlin. Hi, Josh. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Laura. And hello to your guests. I'd just like to say that a lot of the figures that are thrown around as accurate are very inaccurate. And the old saying is that figures lie and liars figure. They have a website called Shadow Stats, and they're saying that the unemployment rate is in the 20 percentile area. And with the jobs, the way they calculate the jobs that are created is if a person loses a good, well-paying with benefits, insurance, so on, and then has to go out and get two or three part-time jobs, they count that as three full-time jobs that are created. And if a person remains unemployed for more than a year, they literally drop off the edge of the world and are not counted. And the other thing I think your guest and your audience should know is the Chinese, even as soon as today, are very close to announcing the UN as a gold-backed currency that's going to replace the dollar, and they are not going to allow U.S. dollars to be converted into the yuan when they do this.
Oh, so the currency manipulation issues definitely come up. You know, but I want to pick up on something else you said, Josh, and thank you for calling, especially Jeff Feingold, since he's from Berlin, which you mentioned earlier has been struggling for a long time because of the mills. Josh is saying, you know, economists have looked at this huge debate over trade and said, hey, what's going on? You know, the economy looks good by the numbers. Josh says, you know, the unemployment rate isn't as good as it looks on the surface, and that's why candidates who are talking about trade so much are getting so much attention and support for that.
Actually, he's basically making that point I made earlier, that there are, you know, people have had these really good-paying jobs, like let's use the paper mill example again. Those were jobs that were very, very high-paying, especially for that area of the state. They were held by generations of families. Then all of a sudden they disappear, and then the new employment up there, is, as we know in the North Country, is it's very difficult to find work, let alone jobs that pay that well. They've had the two prisons built up there, but for the most part, it's a service sector economy that will not pay and will not pay the same kind of level of salary or benefits. And I think when you hear someone like Josh, he is in an area where there is that anxiety is day to day. It's every day. I mean, there is a real economic anxiety up there that I think a lot of people in the southern part of the state can't even understand, because it's been so devastated over the years by loss of manufacturing jobs.
Well, it's good to hear from you, Josh. And, you know, especially since, Jeff, you know, we can say, well, move where the jobs are. But if you live in Berlin, you probably want to stay in Berlin.
Yeah, well, yeah. And also,
you don't want to move to Nashua.
Well, the other thing is, you know, we can get into the whole idea about real estate markets. I mean, if you have a house, what are you going to do with your house? If you're going to sell your house in Berlin, first of all, who's going to buy it? And second of all, what are you going to get for it to be able to move to the southern part of the state where the real estate market is much more expensive?
Josh, thank you for calling in. Again, the number here in the exchange, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Here's an email from Steve in Bedford, who says, I've heard from both parties in this wild campaign that too many jobs have been, quote, shifted offshore, particularly to China. Apple has been mentioned as being particularly guilty. Steve says this is largely baloney, I think. Those jobs are mostly mind-numbing and repetitive. There is no way that these jobs could be done efficiently in the U.S. Apple employs about 107,000 people in the U.S., and those are very good jobs, Steve says. Manufacturing here has changed. It won't go back to the way it was. We need to adapt and move forward. I'll throw that to you, Glenn Brackett. What do you think? Adapt and move forward.
Well, it's hard to adapt and move forward when you're basically working. The labor force in New Hampshire has certain expectations that overseas that you don't have. I mean, in many countries overseas, you have the equivalent of slave labor. I mean, you have low-paid jobs. I mean, in China, where these Apple products are assembled, I mean, the average daily pay is insignificant compared to what a U.S. worker would make. So I don't know how you move forward when the imbalance in wages is so strident.
Steve, thank you for the email. Let's take another call. Gentleman Chris is in Nashua. Hi, Chris. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, Laura. Thanks. I think a lot of this conversation has been very good in terms of talking about the dollars and the net trade balances and the jobs and things like that. But there's another aspect which is, I think, very important to consider, which is the difference between the regulatory environments from the perspective of, like, environment, labor, health, safety, those kinds of standards. And so a lot of these countries are extremely lax in these standards. And so it creates an incentive for companies to be able to say to, a New Hampshire company to say to the state legislature or regulators, if you really want to pass that law or enforce that standard, we may just pick up and go somewhere else where they just don't care about these things. And it creates a downdraft in terms of the quality of life. Like, there's chemicals coming into our food from countries that don't care about this as much, and we don't test like we should. There's Mexican truck drivers that get to enjoy much lower standards, and they get to drive around our roads. There's, speaking of slave wages, there's actually, sweatshops, slave shops over in, certain foreign countries where they really do not care, and people are disposable. I mean, you could go on and on with these kinds of examples. And I think what happens is the net result is that it kind of lowers our standards over time and creates a real reluctance to address issues because the politician is always afraid of being the one responsible for losing the jobs.
Chris, thank you for calling in. And to you first, I think, Matt Slaughter. So our caller is saying, hey, it isn't just the lowering of wages, as Glenn mentioned, but this overall race to the bottom. That's the phrase that you often hear, Matt.
It is. And Chris raises an important point. Vast amount of research that's been done on this, though, shows something slightly different. I think it's important to keep in mind, which is when U.S. companies or other advanced countries' companies expand into these emerging markets, where, yes, the initial wages and oftentimes working conditions are quite different, these companies tend to raise the wages and raise the labor standards and other aspects of the nature of the labor market there. I think that's important to keep in mind. I was just in China, actually, last week, and you just see in the streets with the migrant workers and the people in large cities who were born there, like Shanghai, the amount of dynamism that's been created there. So average income in China today is about $10,000 US. That's vastly different from what it was when they started to connect to the world economy almost 40 years ago, when average income was more like $350 per year. So I think that's important to keep in mind. And yet a second point I'll raise, and Chris is exactly right, we should worry in these trade agreements not just about the border barriers of things like tariffs and quotas, but importantly about the regulatory system in countries, because more and more international commerce is not just things we put on boats and ports. It involves international transactions and services as much as trade and goods. And one of the reasons I think that the Trans-Pacific Partnership is an important agreement that would be good to ratify is because it has some of the most far-reaching agreements on labor standards and environmental standards among the signatory countries.
So trade agreements can pull up living standards,
Absolutely,
saying that. There's another side to this. Okay, and I'll get your thoughts to Glenn and Jeff in just a moment. Thank you for calling, Chris. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. More in a moment. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at international trade from both the New Hampshire and national perspective. It's part of NPR's A Nation Engage project, where this week the network and stations around the country are reexamining the topic because it has been so big in the presidential race this year. We'd love your thoughts. 1-800-892-6477. How do you feel about trade? How do you feel about what the candidates are saying about it? 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Joining us from Hanover is Matt Slaughter, Dean of the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth College. With me in studio, Jeff Feingold, editor of the New Hampshire Business Review, and Glenn Brackett, president of the New Hampshire AFL-CIO. And Glenn, just a moment ago, We had a caller who was expressing his concern about a race to the bottom, so to speak, not just in terms of lower wages, but also lower environmental standards and consumer product standards and so forth. Matt Slaughter made the point that, you know, sometimes the trade elevates standards in other countries. I wonder what you think about this concern about a race to the bottom.
Well, you know, in the TPP and in NAFTA, there is a policy called the Investor State Dispute Settlement System. Now, what that is the system allows for a foreign tribunal of three private attorneys to challenge U.S. laws, regulatory, health, labor, environmental standards, and allows a foreign company to sue a government, either state, municipal, or federal, for loss of expected profits.
Now, in the other country.
In the other country, correct. So currently today, you know, over $3.5 billion has been paid out under NAFTA. Under NAFTA, roughly $15 billion is now still awaiting a decision. Some of these decisions coming down, are huge. You know, currently Chevron is trying to avoid liability in a toxic contamination case in the Amazon. Philip Morris is suing Australia over their cigarette labeling policy. Eli Lilly Pharmaceuticals attacking Canada's drug patent policy. And multiple European companies are suing Egypt over their raising of the minimum wage.
So those are American companies. So are you saying, Glenn, that they are also participating in this race to the bottom? You can't just blame foreign companies.
Right. Any signatory to the TPP or NAFTA is eligible under the ISDS to file suit over lack of expected profits.
I know you want to jump in, Jeff, but Matt, I have to ask you about that because this is a big concern that we hear with these trade agreements, that companies use them in a way to lower standards so that they can increase their profits.
Glenn raises an important point, which is when you have companies engaged in competition, whether it's in domestic markets or international markets, you absolutely want to have some framework to allow there to be disputes to be settled. And I think one of the important things to keep in mind about new agreements like the TPP is they aspire to have more transparent, more agreed upon standards for how these disagreements are going to be disputed. Now, in any particular case, do you like what one particular company is trying to do based on whether they sell cigarettes or another thing? That's an important issue. I don't mean to deny that, but that's an issue that's going to be present whether we have international trade or whether we don't.
Some of the concerns, too, Matt, seem to be not so much on free trade. You know, sure, let's lower tariffs. Some people who typically oppose trade agreements say they don't mind lower tariffs because the U.S. has pretty low tariffs to begin with. So, you know, often that's beneficial to our side of the equation. The problem seems to come, Matt, with these ginormous trade agreements that have all sorts of details and, you know, thousands of pages and so forth. I wonder if some of these problems could be resolved, Matt, if these trade agreements were more simple, or is that just pie in the sky and silly?
No, it's not pie in the sky at all. It's great. But I think it just speaks to the complexity of how global commerce is evolving. I think you hit upon a really important issue, Laura, which is international commerce more and more involves not just trade in goods, but involves, thanks to the advances in technology in particular, we can trade so many services across borders. We can trade education services and movies and all kinds of things like this. So part of why these trade agreements get longer and therefore more difficult to wade through is precisely because countries involved in these agreements are trying to lay down the rules of the road for what all these behind-the-border processes are going to be to try to maintain the desired standards in different countries. And so by definition, it makes it a little bit harder and longer to negotiate these agreements, just like it does in the United States. If you think about consumer protections, child labor laws, environmental standards that we have in the United States, those are complicated issues inside our country. And then when you add roughly a dozen countries involved in similar negotiations in something like the TPP, it's hard to think of a way to not have it involve a handful of pages, unfortunately.
Go ahead, Jeff.
Yeah, I know that several years ago we did a story in the New Hampshire Business Review about the fears that some people have about, at the time it was the World Trade Organization, just this idea that sovereignty of either the federal, state, or local governments it can be challenged by companies outside the United States who are doing business here, maybe over environmental rules or as Glenn was saying, U.S. companies challenging Australia's laws or whatever, and that the same fear was that that it's reciprocates. It could be done here as well. And they had, there was a forum about it, and people were raising concerns about this. It's not quite clear whether that's really it's a genuine fear or not, but it does raise the possibility that that companies from outside the United States can say, well, your environmental laws are just onerous. We can't do business here because, you know, I can do so-and-so in some other country. And it does raise that. It does raise the specter of some kind of tit-for-tat bringing down the regulatory barriers in order for corporations to do business.
Well, and that's something that Texas Senator Ted Cruz has talked about as he campaigns on trade. Now, overall, Senator Cruz has said he favors free trade. But here he is at a Republican debate in Miami in March, sort of offering some of the nuances there.
You got to understand, trade and immigration are interwoven, and they're hurting the working men and women of this country. So the question is, what's the solution? It's easy to talk about the problems, but do you have a solution to fix it? And I think the solution is several things. Number one, we need to negotiate trade deals, protecting American workers first, not the corporate boardroom. Number two, we need to lift the regulations on American businesses here so we see jobs coming back. And number three, we need a tax plan like the tax plan I've introduced that will not tax exports and that will tax imports, and that will bring millions of high-paying jobs back to America.
And again, that's Ted Cruz talking last month in Miami. And, you know, Matt Slaughter, a lot of pieces there. We probably won't get to all of it. But what about the first thing he says? We need to negotiate trade deals protecting American workers first, not the corporate boardroom. He got some applause there. That seems to reflect the sentiment that a lot of workers have about these deals, that they put companies first and workers second.
So that's an important sentiment, and I think it gets back to the fact that when you look at the public opinion data that Danielle rightly pointed to at the top of the show, Americans are ambivalent. They get on the one hand that connecting to the world economy in some broad sense presents an opportunity, and that's definitely right, as we've talked about. And yet the challenge is, how do we try to think about convincing more people that opportunity is going to translate into jobs and higher wages? Again, the academic research and policy research in this is very clear. People who work for a company involved in international trade, those people tend to earn a 15 to 20% wage premium compared to other people in the rest of the private sector. So I think the policy challenge is, how can we write trade agreements and other agreements related to immigration and tax, as Senator Cruz talked about, that's going to allow more companies and therefore more workers in their communities to see being connected to the global opportunity, a global economy as an opportunity.
Well, and to you, Glenn, I mean, when these big trade agreements are written, how much is organized labor, like your group, the AFL-CIO, at the table?
Not at all. TTP is 5,500 pages. That was my understanding. It was written by over 600 multinational corporations. Labor was not at the table for any of the discussion.
Now, why not?
You'd have to ask the people who wrote the legislation.
Go ahead, Jeff.
I was just going to say what Senator Cruz is talking about. The second part of his proposal was to lift regulations on American businesses, and he doesn't specify which businesses. But this is the point where I think I was trying to make, was that he's saying basically let's get rid of some of these regulations. He's not specifically talking about environmental regulations. He's not talking about specific worker protection regulations. But those are some of the regulations that many businesses complain about. So would that help bring jobs back? I mean, I don't know, but is that what his implication is?
I see. So we talked just a moment ago, Jeff, about this race to the bottom and our caller's concern that, trade opens up opportunities for companies to go places where there are less environmental standards, consumer product safety standards, and so forth. Ted Cruz is saying, let's lower those regulations that are here in this country.
That's what it sounds like.
And will the jobs come back? Is that a possibility, Matt Slaughter? Is that why American companies are going overseas, because of regulations here that are too strict?
No, I think the main reason – it's an important question, Laura, but the data show quite clearly the main reason that companies go overseas is to boost their sales. It's very clear when you look at the growth in the world economy over the past 20 or 30 years, and it's that kind of time horizon of many years that a lot of companies, whether they're large multinationals or emerging companies that are exporters, think about, what they're seeing is growth opportunities. And so the ability to sell their goods and services into these foreign markets, to have more of a spur to innovation in what they do here. Does that change the nature of what they do in the United States? Often it surely does. So the scope of what they do here might change, and that's important to keep in mind. But ultimately, that's what creates new jobs and new opportunities for American workers and communities, is a sense of companies having some new opportunity that they can grow into.
Jeff, go ahead.
Yeah, I just want to say that there is a difference between businesses like many in New Hampshire that do business overseas, and they manufacture their products or the services originate in New Hampshire, as opposed to other companies, and we've had many of them, dozens of them in New Hampshire, have shifted their work, their just plants overseas because of lower wages or maybe because of lower standards, environmental standards and other regulations. So, I mean, I think that there's different motivations for different companies. As Matt said, you know, there's a huge world market out there, and a lot of businesses want to take advantage of that. But there's also businesses that are taking advantage of low regulation, of certainly lower wages, and the like.
Well, and important to point out, Jeff, and I think you pointed this out at the beginning, that New Hampshire does have a strong export sector, especially given our relatively small size.
Yes we do. And that and almost all that is from manufacturers of for want of a better term, the advanced manufacturers, you know, people making electronics, high-tech equipment, those kind of things. And they've been thriving in this environment. And as we said, there are other industries that have not. And, you know, I remember several years ago the General Electric closed its meter plant in Somersworth. It had quite a few jobs, and they moved it down to Mexico because of it was cheaper to build the stuff down, to make the stuff down there. And that's just one example. But there are several examples of companies that have closed shop in New Hampshire and moved to other countries, particularly, as I said, Mexico and China.
And sometimes to other states, too, Jeff. I have read, I think, in your publication that sometimes people blame factories that close in New Hampshire on trade, but in fact they've gone to North Carolina or Texas.
It's for the same reason, because there are lower wages and also – perhaps less regulation. I don't know about that.
Or lower costs.
Certainly lower
electricity.
Costs. Yes, absolutely.
Well, here's an email from Dennis who says, many discussions of the loss of manufacturing jobs do not acknowledge the impact of automation. For example, the U.S. still manufactures automobiles, but many fewer workers are needed to do the same job. And thank you, Dennis, for the email. Gentlemen, this is what we keep going around and around on, and I'll turn to you first, Glenn. You know, people blame free trade for lost jobs, but sometimes they are a result of automation, technological innovation, market shifts, shifting consumer demand, and so forth. So it's sometimes more complicated than just, you know, XYZ, we lost it to trade.
As Matt mentioned earlier, it's a multi-pronged, very complex process. But the boogeyman in the room is the free trade agreements. That is something people, it's tangible to them. As was mentioned earlier, you know, when you lose your job and you see your company shut down, like Sprague Electric at Concord did, Batesville Casket in Nashua, Flextronics over in Portsmouth, they shut down and they moved their jobs out of the country. That is something you can tangibly put your finger on and say, this is the reason why I lost my job.
You use the word boogeyman. So is it real or is it sort of imagined?
Well, I think for a lot of people, perception is reality.
What do you think, Matt Slaughter? You've talked about this too.
Boy, Glenn raises a really important issue. Those job transitions that he mentioned, the examples that he just gave, they're very real. And yet that speaks to a theme that a number of people we've discussed on the show, which is important, which is the dynamism of, as Dennis points out rightly in his email, technological change, shifting consumer tastes. International trade is just one of those forces that's constantly shaping and reshaping the U.S. economy. And yet, fairly or not, it's one that when voters go to the polls, it's hard to think about what's a policy that's going to slow innovation or stop technological change throughout the economy. It's easy to see what it might do to the U.S. if we put up a bunch of tariffs against a country like China. So the big policy challenge is, I think, to as important as those anecdotes are, I think, to speaking to the social safety net and the need to strengthen and broaden that, it's important to think about other policies. I think we don't want to shape a lot of our public policies by those anecdotes. We want to shape them by what the data overall show. And as Dennis pointed out, the data show there's a lot of forces that drive dynamism in the U.S. labor market. There's a lot of policy and academic research that shows when U.S. companies expand abroad, as we've been talking about, through hiring and investing abroad, that tends on average to lead to more hiring and more investment and more research and development back in the United States. So I think what's important, and we'll see how the U.S. presidential elections play out, is are we going to have a leader or leaders in Washington that step up to kind of tell a broader story for how globalization can work for more families and communities.
Well, let's hit that point again that you just made, Matt, and I'll throw this to you, Glenn. Some economists like Matt, who are proponents of free trade, say, don't just blame trade. Blame a lack of investment in public education that leaves some Americans behind where they can't adapt as well to a shifting economy, to this dynamic economy. They say that's where your focus should be. You know, public education from kindergarten up through college. I wonder what you think, Glenn. Is that where the AFL-CIO should put its emphasis, not so much on blaming trade, but on a less than robust public education system?
Well, I think infrastructure, public education all play an important part. But I think the important thing was, as we spoke earlier, that if we are going to sign trade agreements that are going to affect the livelihoods of millions of Americans, then we should be ahead of the curve and we should be having a much broader, much wider social safety net in place to start retraining, to offer more support to people who have been displaced. I think that discussion should be had prior to the signatory of any free trade agreement.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is that thanks to investment on the part of taxpayers, federal, state taxpayers, and that's another part of the discussion that we haven't even talked about, was corporations are doing what they want to do, but it's taxpayers are the ones left holding the bag on this.
All right. All of you, lots more to dig into. We've run out of time. Thank you very much for being here. Jeff, it's good to see you. Thank you.
Great seeing you, Laura.
Jeff Feingold, editor of New Hampshire Business Review. Glenn Brackett, good to meet you. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Glenn Brackett, president of the New Hampshire AFL-CIO. Matt Slaughter, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Laura.
Matt Slaughter, dean of the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth College. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producer is Faith Meixel, with help from Jessica Hunt. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kanoy.